The Bible Study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary.
I think there are a couple of ways to evaluate life in America, American culture. You can either stick your head in the sand, or you can work it through. Well, those are your two options. If you're not working it through, I think you've got your head in the sand. Now, if you're going to go about the business of working it through, well, you're going to have to invest a little time, a little energy, because these days, the challenges that we face, morally, ethically, culturally, are pretty formidable. We're going to talk about one of those challenges here on our Ask the Pastor Bible Study as we are joined by Pastor Alan Shade, pastor at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles. We're speaking with him at his home today and doing a little, getting a little home repair work done today, are we, Pastor?
Trying to.
Trying to? The toilet stopped up again?
All kinds of things on the to-do list.
Would you agree with me, yes or no, that when it comes to some of the great moral and ethical and even religious questions of the day, either you're working it through or you've got your head in the sand?
Well, I suppose we have to give some room for people to be so busy in survival mode or trying to stay above water that they don't have time to deal with it. But by and large, if they are struggling with those kinds of things, they are dealing with cultural issues and the demands of culture and the lies and deceits of Satan that are often immersed in culture.
There's an article in the Washington Post newspaper authored by the executive director of the Religious Institute, whatever that is. Her name is Deborah Hafner. She is identified as an ordained Unitarian Universalist minister and executive director of the Religious Institute, a multi-faith organization dedicated to sexual health and justice. Does that sound like a bit of a mixed bag to you?
That would be quite an approach, yes.
Now, when somebody like Deborah Hafner begins to weigh in on one of these questions with which we have to deal, what do you think when you hear those kinds of credentials? Ordained, Unitarian Universalist, and executive director of the Religious Institute, which sounds to me like it would be about religion, but it's actually a multi-faith organization dedicated to sexual health and justice. What do those credentials signify to you?
Well, confusion and not probably, but possibly deceit, but certainly confusion and rejection of basic teachings of Scripture. So if you're Unitarian, you deny the Trinity. If you're Universalist, you deny the possibility that somebody can be lost forever without faith in Jesus Christ. And if you give an equal endorsement to all religions, then you deny the uniqueness of Christianity and the claims of Jesus. So I'd say you're three strikes and you're probably in deep dirt to be able to try to respond to the sexual issues of the day.
Well, this is from yesterday's Washington Post, and the title of Ms. Hafner's piece here is An Open Letter to Religious Leaders on Gay Youth Suicides. It's time to act out loud. Religious leaders, that would be you, would it not?
There's lots of kinds of religious leaders.
Are you prepared to exclude yourself?
I don't think I should, because in the role that I have as pastor, I'm supposed to be a servant leader to the congregation in terms of the teachings of the Scriptures.
She writes, Dear clergy colleagues, well, that would be you.
Well, thank you.
She says, It's Monday morning, and you are probably not quite ready to think about next weekend's sermon. Perhaps you've already announced the upcoming topic in your newsletter. I am praying that you might be willing to change it. October 11th is National Coming Out Day, a day that encourages gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people to publicly state who they are. In light of the at least five gay youth who killed themselves in September, It's time for us to come together as religious leaders and say, enough. I'm hoping that next weekend, from your pulpits, you will come out with your support for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender youth and adults. Yes, you, she writes. Studies show that almost 6 in 10 clergy from mainline denominations support the full inclusion and acceptance of LGBT persons. Yet more than 8 in 10 of us know that our faith communities are capable of becoming more understanding and helpful towards gay teens or those struggling with questions about their sexual orientation or gender identity. Other studies have found that 8 in 10 of even the most progressive clergy don't have programs in their congregations to support LGBT youth. It is past time for us to act out loud. So, Pastor, it would seem that we have an issue here. It is factual that there were 5 suicides that were highly publicized in the month of September. You are in a position, and I suppose I'm in the same position. We can either work through this or stick our heads in the sand. Do you have a preference?
Yes, but I think we have to be careful about how we express it. The double-edged sword is to be faithful to the Scriptures in terms of teaching what the Scriptures say about lifestyle and practices. The other side of that is the compassion with which we respond to individuals so that they that we create a means by which we can actually carry on conversations and bring the message of the gospel to those individuals who, for a wide variety of reasons, may be dealing with sexual issues that they're very confused about or don't understand how they came to be that way, and I guess I'm sensitive to the fact that for some in the gay community, and I wouldn't know the percentage at all, some in the gay community have experienced hatred and rejection by the church for their whole person and not just for their particular behavior issues here, and that closes off any doors we have to relate to these people or to minister to them in a way that helps them work through that and find a place for repentance and redirection of their lifestyle. So it's a very difficult kind of situation for us. Often when we speak honestly about the right and wrong dimension of it, we find it difficulty. I don't know if we lose it, but we find difficulty getting to the next paragraph where we want to try to talk to that person about listening and caring and helping and supporting them. If they have questions, because if they don't get a caring and supporting and a concerned response from Christians about our real desire for them to come to know Jesus, then they're more likely to be affirmed in their choice and then go away from those very people who might be the only ones on earth who can really help them.
So I'm going to guess that at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles, you're not going to be observing National Coming Out Day. Is that a pretty safe guess?
That would be a safe thing.
And why not, Pastor? Don't you care about these 5 poor young people who killed themselves in September?
Well, care about their families and regret that that has happened. And we just worked through a book in our Sunday morning Bible studies called Unchristian, Dan Kinneman, Gabe Lyons, and they have an entire chapter dealing with unfortunate things that have been done in the name of Christian religion to give Christians a bad name about what we mean in our expressions of concern about the homosexual and lesbian community. He has some awful quotes about what Christians have said on the air or done in posters, or how they've attacked people or beaten individuals because of their lifestyle choices, and given many Christians such a bad name that we find it difficult even to try to create platforms or conversation places where we can meaningfully discuss this with them in a law and gospel means, a law and gospel manner.
Well, that means that if we're going to work it out here instead of sticking our heads in the sand, and I can see where, based on the articulation of your answer, the careful articulation of your answer, you communicated to me at least one thing, and that is there is no easy one-sentence response to this challenge or this question. So if we're going to work it out, and we're going to work it out with sensitivity, but with an eye on the truth, then we're going to have to work at it a little bit. So, Pastor, how do you work through it, remaining faithful to the Word of God, but also faithful to your call to be a shepherd, a caring man, one who may have in your care at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles GLBT young people who are, as Deborah Hafner writes here, are at risk, are seriously at risk. How do you work that through?
Well, I think our fundamental portrait of Christ and how he deals with all sin and how he deals with people who are in slavery to sin, with both a concern for their eternal welfare and a sensitivity to the struggle that they have, and efforts to listen and to demonstrate that there is not just judgment but also a concern for their welfare. We try to build that into the portrait of Jesus so that what we're talking about, you're using one specific example of a sin issue, but we're trying to build that in terms of this is how we think about all sin. It's very easy for us to slide into our hypocritical self-righteous mode and be judgmental about everybody else's sin and not look at our own. But we also have a pattern of we pick out our five worst sins in the world. And most of those sins don't show up on our particular behavior list. And then we grind those down or make placards or go out and beat up people in emotionally or physically based on particular sins and say, oh, yeah, homosexuality is far worse than gossip. That kind of thing. You challenge people to be thinking Christians who have a distinctly biblical worldview and who respond with both the law and gospel framework in every situation in which they face. Okay, so if Chuck Rathard or Al Shade was trapped in a situation where we had succumbed to those things, how would we want the Christian church to respond to us? Well, one part of me would say, well, I want you to approve my behavior so I can go ahead and keep doing this. On the other hand, if you're going to reach out to me, I also want you to do it in such a way that I see Jesus in your face and I hear Jesus in your words.
Do you want, let's just say hypothetically, that there is a 16-year-old gay young person in your parish. You are not aware of that fact or that reality. That young person is struggling with his or her sexual identity, and it's rough. And I wouldn't say that the person necessarily is suicidal, but they're depressed and they're hurting. Do you want that young person to come see you, Pastor?
I would hope that they would, but I also know that it may not be a pastor that is the one with whom they can confide, or because of my role both as a pastor and as a one perceived with authority or responsibility, they may not be able to, but I would hope that somehow in the congregation they would find someone that is sensitive enough and caring enough that they could confide and begin to seek some help and some healing.
Well, of course, the difference between you and everybody else, quote-unquote, in the congregation is that you really do understand confidentiality. You have, I believe,
exactly right.
Even in your your ordination or your installation vows, you state that publicly, do you not, that you will honor all confidentiality.
On an intellectual level, I think they can understand that pastors have the seal of the confessional. They have the protection of confidentiality. But they don't just see that. They also, from an emotional side, are going to see a pastor as somebody with authority and somebody that has to take charge in situations and may have some responsibilities that by other standards are going to require them to do something. You know, it's like becoming aware that you have somebody associated with your school that's a sex offender. I mean, you want to have the seal of confidentiality, but you have responsibilities also against protecting other people from that, and there are legal implications and so on. So they, on an intellectual level, they would understand the seal of the confessional and the protection they would have. On an emotional level, I think they would have a lot to work through to be able to just come into a pastor's office and say that kind of thing. You know, so that you have to try to build support systems or opportunity systems for a number of people to be able to do that would not necessarily not necessarily be a pastor, but with some skills and training that would be comparable to a pastor.
All right, let's wrap up this particular conversation. I'm going to jump toward the end of this article by Deborah Hafner. She says, and I'm cherry-picking a little bit here, she says, what if next weekend all of us told them, that is LGBT youth, from our pulpits how heartbroken we are by Tyler Clemente's suicide and that we want to make sure that no young person in our community would ever feel such despair? You may remember that Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote, quote, silence in the face of evil is itself evil. God will not hold us guiltless. Not to speak is to speak. Not to act is to act, unquote. It is time for all of us to act. So Deborah has referenced what we would otherwise call a rather famous Lutheran preacher from the right. World War II era. Mm-hmm. What do you make of it?
Well, I can't speak against the concept that Bonhoeffer spoke, because you and I have all been in situations where we knew very clearly that to not speak was contrary to the word and will of God. I don't like her use of guilt, laying a guilt trip on us to make us do something that really ought to flow from compassion and from the gospel of our Lord Christ. But she makes a salient point that when the church has an opportunity to respond and it comes across only with a law statement or a judgmental perspective and doesn't offer the opportunity for grace and support and forgiveness, it's unfaithful to the responsibility that we have. Same kind of thing that would happen on, say, Life Sunday. On Life Sunday in January, lots of Missouri Synod congregations, I would hope all of them, would have an aspect in which they talk about the responsibility to support and defend life. But at that same time, if the pastor isn't thinking, he may suggest somehow to a lady sitting in the congregation or a couple in the congregation who has carried out an abortion, that if they suggest there's no forgiveness for that, or it's some kind of unforgivable sin, or that they don't need compassion and support and caring from people who can wrap their arms around them if they're struggling with guilt. If we fail to do that, we're not faithful to the gospel. So, I've got to give her some points for getting to the issue, and points also to say, well, let's stay law and gospel balanced on this so that there is some way of creating a sense that Jesus had compassion for people who were overwhelmed by sin and wanted to reach out to them, not just to throw them in the garbage dump.
All right, I'd like to play for you a television report that was on ABC television after this past weekend, the activity in the National Football League. You will not have the benefit of video, but I think the report speaks for itself, so Let's listen to it together.
So it was caught on camera. There you go, flashing a single finger salute after a call against his team. Cecil could be fined by now by the NFL, but one player described his actions as awesome, saying he's sure his teammates will chip in to help him out.
You may remember just last year, the NFL slapped the owner of the Titans with a $250,000 fine for making the same obscene gesture.
Oh, see, we see that a lot here in New York. That sign doesn't bother me too much anymore.
So, Pastor, the report here is during an NFL game involving the Tennessee Titans, there was a coach who did not like a call from an official, and the coach was caught on television making a vulgar gesture toward the officials. And I'm wondering whether you think this is problematic, or whether it's, well, it's just the way it is these days, or how you view it.
It's one of those things where I'm an old-fashioned and ultra-conservative kind of person, and I would think a very appropriate thing would be to fire him and fine him a year's salary. First, for being acting like a three-year-old instead of an adult. Secondly, for disrespecting the authority that is placed there. Thirdly, for setting an awkward example. And, you know, I'll just keep on creating the list, but I find it a vulgar and offensive gesture. I despise the fact that the culture is kind of encouraging it as something that every once in a while you really ought to do just to express your frustrations. And I don't think I would go the route of having both index fingers cut off of the man's hand. But
we just talked about Matthew 18 in the previous in the previous hour. So
did you express did the gentleman express any repentance for his gesture so far?
I think the jury's out on that yet. Haven't caught up with that yet. But
if he repents, forgiven, but he still has consequences for his behavior. If he's going to take a salary, I suppose he gets more than $25 a week.
Well, now make up your mind, Pastor. You want to forgive him, or do you want him to have consequences?
Both. If he repents, forgive him. If he thinks that by repenting he should avoid the consequences, then he's even more naive than I described him earlier. So he still has consequences. If the gentleman's going to behave like that, then I'd throw the book at him and ban him from coaching for at least a year.
The NFL is certainly not an ecclesiastical entity. It's not a church. And let's just assume for a moment that this coach is an atheist. Do principles like if he repents, forgive him, still work outside of the church?
If he's a practicing atheist, I don't think he's going to call me and ask for forgiveness. If the NFL expresses to him that he must apologize to everyone involved, then he ought to do it. But I still don't think that excuses him from the consequences for it.
The main reason I wanted to play this audio for you and for those who are listening to us is because everything you said, and I tend to agree with it, I think you described pretty much what is a harsh view of this behavior. You don't sound like you give much quarter to this kind of behavior, and I agree with you. But the reporters pointed out that one of the players pretty much thought this was great. This was sort of their coach being a team guy. And if the players thought that they got a raw deal from the officials, then the coach was actually standing up for the players. What do you make of that?
Well, it's confusion. Standing up for his players is one thing, but there are ways to do that. I mean, you can stand up for something in the congregation that you disagree with and challenge your pastor. But pulling out a .45 revolver and shooting him is not considered an appropriate way to express your dissent or something of that nature. I mean, the confusion is that, yes, there are ways to express support for your team, but there are improper ways to express that and to confuse those. And I think we're just proving the case. If the players are so immature that they think that kind of gesture is really a way to stand up for the team, then those players need a far better example than they're getting from that coach, because they're learning learning to be three-year-olds instead of learning to be men.
You're listening to the Ask the Pastor Hour on the Bible Study with Pastor Alan Shade, Emmanuel Lutheran Church, St. Charles. We'll be right back.
Maybe you think the liturgy is an outdated and incomprehensible way to worship God. The liturgy was already old when J.S. Bach lived. In his Mass in B minor, Bach explores what the liturgy says and what it does for the worshiper. Come, hear the Mass in B minor at Concordia Seminary, October the 10th at 3 o'clock. Bach at the Sem, October 10th at 3 o'clock.
Calling all adventurous, nature-loving families, here's your opportunity to sleep under the stars amid the Missouri Botanical Garden's lush green landscapes. The sleepover includes dinner, a late-night snack, and a light continental breakfast in the morning. You don't need tents. Everything is provided. This is for families with children ages 6 to 12. It'll take place on October 9th to 10th at the Missouri Botanical Garden. For more information about this great adventure, go to mobot.org.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
It's been exactly 30 years since China began enforcing its brutal one-child policy to control their population. Family planning thugs often jail couples who dare to have more than one child. Sentences involve house arrest and labor camps. They endure physical harassment and violence. Women late in pregnancy are literally being drugged to abortion mills where their babies are killed and they're forcibly sterilized afterward. If the women flee, officials often arrest family members instead. A drastic shortage of women has resulted, and China has the highest suicide rate in the world among women. I spoke with one of the victims who was forced to have three abortions without anesthesia. All the while, so-called pro-choice groups remain deadly silent.
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
Thou shalt not. I'm Steve Coleman with today's Religion Roundup. A student at a Bible college in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, has been shot to death in his dorm room, and school officials say another student is responsible. Mid-Atlantic Christian University says on its website that sophomore Jonathan Shipper was killed Sunday. The school statement says the shooting appeared to be a personal matter between two students. The statement also said the person believed to have shot Shipper surrendered to police. Former President Jimmy Carter and his wife Rosalynn have helped build a home with Habitat for Humanity in Washington just days after a viral infection landed him in a Cleveland hospital.
I'm perfectly okay. It was just a temporary stomach virus, and God has blessed me in many ways, and one of those has been good health so far.
The 86-year-old Carter said this is his 27th year volunteering with Habitat for Humanity and that he plans to continue doing the work as long as God lets him. I'm Steve Coleman.
If it's in the headlines, we'll think about it. If it's a topic of conversation at the water cooler, we'll discuss it. If it's something we need to remember, I'll remind you. Hi, this is Dale Meyer, inviting you to hear the Meyer Minute on KFUO Radio. Weekday mornings and afternoons, I'll bring you fresh commentary from a Christian perspective. The Meyer Minute, addressing today's topics the way God sees it on KFUO Radio.
It's a special concert of American music at the Sheldon Concert Hall and Grand Center, October 11th at 8 p.m. Composers Aaron Copland, Martin Mailman, Randall Thompson, and others will be heard, along with arrangements of American folk music for chorus and small instrumental ensemble on a program of music by American composers and music on American themes. More information is available online at thesheldon.org.
You're listening to our Ask the Pastor Bible Study. I'm Chuck Rathert. Thank you for spending some time with us. Pastor Alan Shade is with us. He is pastor at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles. I think I'm just going to play this report again here, if I can bring it up on my computer here, so those who may not have heard it in the first half hour can hear it on this half hour. Maybe not. All right, it's not going to work. So anyway, I'm sorry about that, Pastor Shade. I have one more question for you as it pertains to this question. What I had here was audio from ABC News and video of a coach in an NFL game giving the middle finger salute to the officials, and then the reporters telling us that one of the players thought that this was great. My last question to you on this issue is that I have the privilege and the great fun of officiating football myself. At the varsity level, at the underclass level, freshmen through seniors. And one of the things that I've noticed is that, in particular among underclassmen, is their penchant for the potty mouth. They drop the F-bomb, they drop the S-bomb, they do it, and they don't seem to be at all concerned that I'm standing there, and they seem to be surprised if I confront them on that and tell them that we're not going to have that kind of language. I wonder if they're taking their cues from coaches in the NFL or some of these other bad examples. What do you think?
Well, the examples are so plentiful in so many places. They don't have to single out NFL coaches on that kind of basis. It's just rampant everywhere, and I'm surprised at times when people use some of that language in the vicinity of a pastor, even knowing it's a pastor, and don't give it a second thought.
Well, that's kind of discouraging to hear you say that this is rampant everywhere. That's pretty much as bad as it. Are we stuck with this, you think, Pastor, for the rest of at least your time and my time on this earth?
Only until Christ comes again. I assume in some ways it's new or worse in each generation as life deteriorates, but Christ did describe out of our mouth proceed all sorts of evil things, and unfortunately sometimes the mouth is the last thing to be redeemed by people and transformed to fit the description in Colossians 4, where it talked about a language that's seasoned with salt and so on.
Yeah, salty language.
Sorry, that's Colossians 4, not Ephesians. So.
All right, let me ask you about this. Diane Summers provided this to me from an emailer. Sent it to her. She passed it on to me. Interesting email here, complete with photographs, about a man who has built Noah's Ark to the exact scale given in the Bible. It's a working, in other words, it floats. It's a working
wow.
replica of Noah's Ark, and it has been opened in a place called Schagen, Netherlands. The massive central door in the side of Noah's Ark was opened, and the first crowd of curious townsfolk beheld the wonder. This replica of the Ark was built by Dutch creationist Johan Huibers, Huibers, as a testament to his faith in the literal truth of the Bible. You don't have the photographs here, but it is a massive structure. There are photographs of the inside of the Ark. And the builder says, "I knew the story of Noah, but I had no idea the boat would have been so big. There is enough space near the keel for a 50-seat film theater where kids can watch a video that tells the story of Noah and his ark." Huibers said he hopes the project will renew interest in Christianity in the Netherlands, where church going has fallen dramatically in the past 50 years. Do you think this is a good idea? And I thought that, you know, this would be particularly a good question for you, because don't you have a Noah's Ark restaurant out there in St. Charles, Pastor, or you used to anyway?
Well, we used to. That's been leveled. It had fallen into terrible disrepair. What I thought of was the Christian drama presentation that's done down at Branson of Noah's Ark, where they build a theater that allowed you to have a sense that when you were in the theater, you were sitting inside Noah's Ark, and you were half surrounded by animals and such. And I thought they did a masterful job. And I was thrilled because when we came out of the theater, my son was there, and several of our grandchildren saw it. And every generation was just wowed with what the story represented and the message that came through with it. So hats off to the gentleman. I would not have the time or the resources to do that kind of thing, but if that's the way in which you can open a door through which, pardon the pun, if you can open a door through which people will gain, get into conversations about God, His role in our world, and His greatest gift of the Son, then that's a wonderful thing.
There's nothing in you that causes you to think this is a little gimmickry, is there?
Well, why would we be terribly concerned about gimmickry? I mean, he will be accused of that, and there may be a little bit of it that the timeliness of it may be a very brief time of opportunity before it's grabbed, but I think we can take advantage of some of those kinds of things once in a while, as long as that's not the only thing that we do for reaching out to the people of this world. But if you have a man with a great commitment, with lots of insights about how the story that's told in Genesis 6, 7, and 8 has some reliable scientific evidence or plausibility background and stuff like that, if he can make an inroad in the hearts and lives of some people, then more power to him.
Well, if the issue is faith in Jesus Christ, trusting faith in Jesus Christ, do you think you can get from point A to point B by building a really big boat and telling people about Noah?
Well, what was Noah prophesying about? He was talking about a God who rescues us, and there's no greater rescue story than the cross and resurrection. If you use the rainbow, people can connect with rainbows because they see them, and they can see them as a reminder of the faithfulness of God to His promises and so on. There's just an enormous number of connection points, plus Noah's imagery is used in 1 Peter as a baptismal imagery, so there are lots of little rivulets that come out of that story that you can pursue for understanding and for connecting people to the foot of the cross.
I'll probably make it to Branson before I make it to the Netherlands, so I'll have to...
Better hurry. I don't know that show's going to be on there yet another year.
Oh, okay. All right. Let me mark that in my calendar. Now, that was a little bit of a lighthearted subject there, Pastor. We're going to turn our attention to something else here. Again, I want to play some audio for you. This is audio coming from the United Kingdom. The voice that you will hear, the primary voice, is that of Virginia Ironside. She is a so-called celebrated advice columnist of the Independent newspaper. And she was a guest on a television program. For those who are able to see the video, there is a moderator. Virginia Ironside, the celebrated writer, is the primary voice you will hear, and there is also what appears to be a clergywoman sitting on the set. I apologize for those of you who don't handle the British dialect very well, but let's all work together and see if we can pick up what's being said here. This is commentary by Virginia Ironside on child suffering and one of the avenues that she sees to speaking to child suffering. Let's listen.
True, no, and I think that if I were a mother of a suffering child, I would be the first to want, I mean, a deeply suffering child, I would be the first to want to put a pillow over its face.
Dr. Peter Evans
as I would with any suffering thing. And I think the difference is that my feeling of horror, suffering, is much greater than my feeling of getting rid of a couple of cells, because suffering can go on for years.
I'm sorry, I was just about to introduce another.
Were you able to pick that up, Pastor?
Unfortunately, yes.
The two key comments there in this part of the interview, Virginia Ironside declaring that it is somehow kind if you have a deeply suffering child to put a pillow over its face or to smother it to death, and that getting rid of a couple of cells, as she calls it, apparently is her idea of being kind and thoughtful. So what's your initial reaction?
This has been around for a long time, and I think it was first called utilitarianism, in that a small group of people sets itself up to determine what is an acceptable level of life happiness, and they are quite willing to impose that on other people. The inconsistency that usually shows up is that if it happens to then apply to them, they swiftly become the exception to the plan. Just out and about doing an errand this morning, I had a radio show on that had a similar kind of interview, and the daughter of a woman who advocated these things challenged her mom and said, if you were going to follow that logic, then you would have killed me when I began to be ill as a child. And the woman said, oh, well, of course that wouldn't apply to us, as though there's a natural a barrier that people can say, well, these things don't apply to us, that they should apply generally in the world so that my world can be a better place to live. Just really off the deep end in terms of a willingness to play God and to impose those standards and wreak havoc in the lives of countless other individuals.
Well, the director on this UK television program was a pretty savvy director, because after Virginia Ironside made the comment that perhaps the kindest thing you can do for a deeply suffering child is put a pillow over its face, they took a shot of the moderator and they took a shot of the clergywoman, and both appeared visibly stunned by those comments. Their stunned looks did not dissuade Virginia Ironside from pressing on. And I guess my next question to you, Pastor, is I think there was a time when if somebody had said something like this in public, in a broadcast, so that hundreds and thousands of people could see it, there would have been immediate outrage. There would have been condemnation of Virginia Ironside. It would have been wall to wall. And we would have moved quickly to restabilize our sensibilities after having been offended by Virginia Ironside. But, you know, you don't see that very much anymore. People say the most outrageous and radical things, justifying killing a child, which I think you and I would call murder. And we all just raise our eyebrows and go, well, that's kind of weird, and move on. Agree or disagree?
I think you put your finger on an issue of our day, and that is the kind of shock value that is frequently put into things that go out in the movie or television or I think I saw a commercial not too long ago on TV that suggested a video game of extreme violence, and they titillated the listeners by saying, well, we can't show that level of extreme violence on television, so you'll have to spend the money to get the video game. And you think, well, my goodness, look at all the violence we do see on television. What might that be? So there's a deadening of the sensitivities that is done because this is everywhere. The discussion that we had tried to have a little earlier about sexual perversion that is part of society and culture and pushing the lines of all of that is typical, and that sex is everywhere. It's in music, it's in literature, it's in movies, it's on TV, it's in commercials, it's used as a means by which to sell. And shock value is kind of the same thing, so that if a person is trying to program 24 hours a day on one channel against 250 other channels or 400 other channels, you are tempted to use some kind of shock presentation, because if you don't, people will click past you. If you say something that makes sense, if you say something that is espoused by majority values or anything of that nature, people will say, well, I've heard all that, I don't want to listen to that, and they'll go on to something else. So it's a ratings issue, it's advertising dollars and all of those kinds of things. You get ratings when you have some kind of a what I would think hopefully would be a lunatic fringe, but if they sound erudite and they may have some letters behind their name, or they're connected with a certain group of people, that they can say those kinds of things and be thought brilliant and intellectual and ahead of their time.
Pastor Shade, I already know the answer to this next question. I know the answer is because there is sin in the world, but I'm looking for a little bit more depth in your answer to this question. I'm wondering what it is, do you think, that causes some people to be so married to the notion of killing other people, to be so intent about defending a woman's right to kill her unborn child, to be so wedded to the notion that we just have, the state just has to have the power to euthanize people who have lived their lives and are now just taking up space in the hospital. Or this is the one that puzzles me the most. Given the current state of stem cell technology, everything that I've seen and read suggests that adult stem cells are where the answers are when it comes to stem cell advancement. And embryonic stem cells don't have that much promise. But we have people who are just absolutely wedded to the notion that we have to kill these embryos in the name of science. What is it in us that causes us to covet the right or the privilege to kill other people?
I think it's a similar line of thinking that has become more popular because an evolutionary line of approach devalues the significance of a life. When we lived in a world that had a sense of a soul or an immortal soul and a line between human beings and the rest of creation, there was a greater sense of the value of each individual person. But at this point, when we're just sort of part of a pathway along that's going to get even better, and when you have a process where, well, when you die, you go back into the soil and you become a part of a process that eventually will generate something new and different and the progression, then the individuals become less valuable, and if they're not the right ones to keep for survival, then they're discardable. They're stuff you can throw off. You know, if you have an NFL team, and I don't, but if you have an NFL team, you're going to keep 45 players, but you're going to discard 150 that tried out, and your reason is, well, you have to have the most successful and the most the best collection of players that are going to give you victory. And if you start doing that same kind of thing and saying, well, we're going to be overpopulated in the world and we only have to keep the best and the brightest and the most likely to provide us with success and satisfaction for the coming years, then you have to start eliminating. You know, the question you raised becomes a thunderous one, and you had it over the break with the comment about the abortion process in China and the reduction of families and the elimination of children, all for this cause that, well, China doesn't have enough room for all those people, so of course you have to eliminate some of those people, and as long as it's not me that gets eliminated, I can develop a tolerance for it.
Is it too fanciful, or is it too outside the realm of reality to say that when Satan promised Adam and Eve that if they ate of the forbidden fruit that they would be like God, are we still trying to be like God, Pastor? And the one thing we know about God is that he has the power to give and take life. So we should too.
Essentially, I remember listening to Don Abdon teach that in his adult instruction class, and this goes back to the 70s, and it really struck me that what Satan was offering to Adam and Eve was you couldn't trust God to be God because he really doesn't love you. He hates you. He doesn't have your best interests at heart. So you need to make the choice to be God for yourselves and to decide what's good and evil, what's good and what's evil. And as long as every individual has that right to decide for himself and has himself in the center of the circle of the most important things in this world, self-worship, then somebody that interferes with that is going to be rejected and, if necessary, toddlers, and the toddlers were very quick to decide which one should have the toy, no matter what they had to do to the other toddler to get the toy.
The expressions on the faces of these two women as they listen to Virginia Ironside is something that I wish that our listeners could see, because they are not only surprised or amazed at what Virginia Ironside is saying, they are clearly aghast. And in spite of that, they retain their decorum. They do not condemn the woman. They do not go on the offensive. And perhaps for a television program, they shouldn't. But should we, Pastor, having seen this woman make this case for putting a pillow over the face of a deeply suffering child and smothering it to death, does there come a point when you and I, as Christians who understand that God's will is not for smothering children, need to take up the shield of faith and the sword of the Spirit and let's go to war? Is that time arrived yet?
The time arrived a long time ago, and it's been part of the Christian witness for as long as I know of anything in church history, that when examples of violation of God's word and will and an attack on the holiness of God and the well-being of man, that war's been going on a long time. It's just giving us different illustrations of it and encouraging us to be faithful in the combat. Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. If we took that to heart, then the concept that Ms. Ironside was advocating would be absolutely abhorrent to anybody who took the words of Jesus seriously. So it's just providing us more examples of that, but still proclamation of Christ in all of his fullness.
Sometimes it feels an awful lot like we've got our shield and our sword tucked neatly away in the closet, and we are not on the offensive. We're not even holding ground. We're in retreat, hot retreat. Would you disagree with that assessment?
I think there are lots of places where Christians have kind of abandoned the playing field to Satan and said, can't fight it anymore. Or where the silence of young people, silence of people, has encouraged the young to think, oh, I guess mom and dad don't care about that anymore because they watch those movies or they use that kind of language or they do this and they do that, and there's not a verbalized witness, and they, maybe parents believe the right stuff, but when they don't say it, it doesn't get passed on to the next generation with any kind of faithfulness at all. So, and then there is the constant fear that you're going to be laughed at or mocked or pilloried or some other kind of unfortunate treatment given to you. And most of us are cowards in one way, shape, or the other. So we avoid battles that might put us at risk for some pain, emotionally or physically or monetarily or something of that nature.
Pastor, thank you so much for taking some time away. I know you're busy at home there. You're dealing with some issues there at home and getting some repairs made. So appreciate you taking time during your busy day, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Glad to do it, Chuck.
All righty.
God bless.
And to you, sir. Pastor Alan Shade, Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles, and our Ask the Pastor conversation here on this Tuesday. Tomorrow, we will finish Matthew 18 with Pastor Tim Ostermeyer. He gets verses 21 through 35. He's pastor at Hope Lutheran Church in St. Anne. And I'm going to try anyway, if I can get my technical stuff to work. I'm going to bring the Bill O'Reilly, Bill Maher shootout to Pastor Kevin Golden's attention on the Ask the Pastor program.
And guest pastors Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study archives at kfuo.org. The Bible study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.